Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for joining us, virtual audience. Thank you for coming. I'm really excited. For the first time, we have William Maz, author of The Bucharest Dossier, and as you can see, The Bucharest Legacy here at the Poison Pen. Now, The Bucharest Dossier created a huge stir when it published, and like many first novels, they didn't print loads and loads of books, so it was fairly rare. I'm trying to remember, I think it was our historical mystery book of the month last year, whenever month it published in.
March.
No, you have to hold the.
It was March. It was the Ides of March, March 15th when it came out.
Right, but I think we had to chase you down, and probably was like April or May by the time we coordinated it all, because it involved shipping. Anyway, the Bucharest Dossier takes us to Romania. And I say historical because it's hard to write about Romania without dealing with the 1989 uprising against Nicolae Ceaușescu and his wife, which I think was actually maybe the execution was on Christmas.
Right on Christmas Day. That's why it was called the Christmas Revolution. He died on December 25th.
And to the end was incredulous as far as I could work out. He and his wife. I've been to Romania. Three times, I think it is, but only once to Bucharest. If you take a cruise around the Black Sea, which you can't really do successfully now, but in 2011, we were able to do that. You do visit Constanța and the Danube Delta, which is absolutely gorgeous, and take you out in little boats, and you know, sort of like the Everglades, but different and exciting. But I was very excited about going to Bucharest because really under Ceaușescu, I think most Americans didn't have any familiarity with Romania.
No, they didn't have a chance to actually be tourists in Bucharest. They didn't make it easy. Tourists were always suspicious to them. The Securitate, which was the KGB version, in Romania, was always following you around. If you visited during Ceaușescu's time, if you had relatives there, they would question the relatives as to what they talked about to you. And so it wasn't even good for your relatives for you to visit, because it would put them in some sort of trouble sometimes. So, you know, but nevertheless, one of my relatives was a well-known actress there, and she had some protection, as they call it, which is really a mafia word, but that's kind of what the place was like, and it still is. And so she didn't have that much trouble with my visiting. So I visited a lot, and I got to see what the Ceaușescu regime was about.
Are you Romanian by birth?
I was born in Bucharest of Greek parents, like my hero, Bill Heflin. So that's another example of using some of your own history in your books. We left when I was six. Why we were allowed to leave, that's a big question mark in my family, because it was rare for people to be allowed to leave. But we were Greek citizens, my parents were, so they finally let us go. And we stayed in a refugee camp in Greece for 2.5 years, like Heflin does for 1 year. And then we came to America when I was eight.
Well, I was very interested I'd had no idea what to expect in Bucharest. I knew that we had booked into the Athenae Palace, which was...
You did.
Oh, it was gorgeous. And it's right across the way from a really beautiful concert hall, art center, on the, you know, just to the east of it. But very European in feeling, very Parisian, actually, in feeling.
The Athenae Palace was a center of life, really, from the day it was built in the early part of the century, all through Second World War. It was where all the spies met. In fact, there was a book called The Athenae Palace, written by a... American or British journalist, I can't remember her name. She spent like months at the Athenae and met everybody that was anybody in the halls and in the bars and so forth. Affairs, intrigues, spies from different nations met there at the bar. So I try to portray some of that in the first book and a little bit in the second. Because really, the spy network was like a Wild West when we neared the revolution in December of '89, and then immediately afterward, it really became the Wild West, partly because the Romanian spies, the Securitate, no longer just worked for the government, they worked for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they eventually became the oligarchs. And we need to go into that, how that happened. But
right. Well, it's very walkable around the Athenae Palace to some highlights of Bucharest. And one thing I want to point out, it has maybe the most beautiful bookstore I have ever been in. It's in a former bank, and it's, I think, five stories high. Has a little cafe up at the top. I have photos of it because we were all smitten with bookstore envy. It was like, really wanted to go home. It was a lovely repurposing, you know, of a financial institution. There's a great museum. Romania was a kingdom, and Queen Marie of Romania is kind of a legendary figure. And from that, if you're a tourist, you depart for Transylvania, where there really isn't Dracula, but nonetheless, there's a room of Dracula's castle and all. It's just, you know. But Queen Marie actually lived there. Rhys Bowen, wrong author. Laurie King was with me and was writing a book in which Queen Marie of Romania and the whole Dracula thing was a part of it. So I think, you know, many of us, our view of Romania was more romantic and more probably pre-war. And, you right. know, not so much the Ceausescu regime, because we were cut off from it.
Well, absolutely. Now, Romania between World War I and World War II was pretty wealthy. They had a king, Michael, and then before that, Carl. They had a free market system. And so they had oil in the place, the oil fields, and it was the breadbasket of the area, rich land. And so a lot of Greeks went there. That's how my grandparents went there. And of course, what did they do? They started restaurants and became wealthy. And then at the beginning of World War II, Romania had a fascist government. And for half the war, until actually 44, I think it was on the side of Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, they joined the German army to attack Stalingrad, where my father was a doctor in the war there. And he barely escaped with his life because his sergeant told him to get on the truck because they needed a doctor. The rest of the people had to go walk home, the troops. So that's how he saved them. Half the Romanian army was decimated at Stalingrad. Anyway, so after that, the Russians came and invaded, and Romania turned communist, and my parents couldn't leave anymore. And so my brother and I were born there, and we grew up there until for some reason we were allowed to go.
Yeah, well, when I was young, that Eastern Bloc, which was communist, was, as I say, walled off, you know. So we knew very little about it, never had a chance to visit. I do remember, and I think it's Romania, not Bulgaria, that, and I think Mark Sullivan talks about it in his book about the Ukraine, that there were many Germans who actually settled in that, you know, agriculturally, because it was very rich agricultural land. And so there was a real debate, as I remember, about whether Romania would join the Nazis or the other side. Alan First, and, you know, he's got at least one of his great books set down in that area.
Well, it was even more than that, because Hitler basically said, you either join us or we invade, because we need the oil for our tanks. So Hitler wasn't going to let them. And so they basically installed a fascist government. And that's how that happened. But then everybody hated the Germans, unfortunately. The Romanian got into it. Nobody knew why they were fighting in the war on the side of the Nazis. In fact, they also didn't like the Russians. So They didn't know who to fight. The Romanians.
Right. You know, it was, that whole area is a very difficult area because of back and forth with culture and nationalities and loyalties and the whole bit.
Romania was under so many different conquerors, Austro-Hungarian Empire,
the
Ottoman Empire. I mean, the Russians on one side. But they were Francophiles. They loved the French. My father studied medicine there in French. So he was a Greek that emigrated to Romania and then had to learn French to study medicine. And then came back to Greece for 2 years and then came to America, had to learn English to study medicine again. So
there we are. Well, a part of this history is because the novel, much of the backstory takes place in the 1970s. And then the forward story is in April of 1993, which is just over 3 years after the end of the Ceausescu regime. But let's go back and talk about the Bucharest Dossier. Would it be fair to say that it would really be better to read this book before you read the Bucharest Legacy? I think there are a lot of spoilers in Legacy if you
Absolutely.
Hadn't read the dossier.
If you're going to read both, you should read them in order. The rule in writing a sequel or a series is each book should stand on its own. So I try to fill in some of the backstory in the second book so that you won't, you know, be lost, so you'll know what you're doing. But if you're going to, there are spoilers in the second book about the first, so you really should read them in order.
Right. And a lot of it has to do with Bill Heflin, whose actual name, give us his Greek name, because one of the reasons he has his nickname is, as a child, is because of the Greek.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, his Greek name is Argyris, which means silver-haired. But even that, according to his father, was a made-up last name, because it really was somebody in Greece went from one place to another, and so, you know, they didn't know his last name or if he didn't have one, but so they called him Silver-Haired. So the point of the book is he changes his name when he leaves home in Massachusetts to go to college, because he doesn't want to be labeled an immigrant. Okay, he doesn't like to be part of the Greek and Romanian immigrant community in Massachusetts, where he grows up, because he sees it as a swamp. And he sees how people who have stayed in that community remain there for the rest of their lives. They can't get out. He wants to be a true American, so he changes his name, and he gets to college, where for the first time in his life, he isn't asked how to pronounce your name, where were you born, and everything else. He becomes a real American. He feels more accepted. And that's where he gets recruited by the CIA. When he's at Harvard and he joins the Fly Club, which is one of these all-men clubs at Harvard. I think now they've become for women too. But those clubs were a place where the CIA would recruit people. And Yale had their own clubs like that too. And he gets recruited and becomes an analyst. And it's also a place where he meets Catherine, who is also part of this clan of recruited CIA spies while in college, and she teaches him a lot of things.
A lot of martial arts. I thought your discussion about, you know, the difference between jujitsu and Krav Maga and whatever. Catherine is a really kick-ass lady. She is. And he needs those skills, as it all turns out.
Absolutely. Well, it's like the Chekhov rule that says if you show a gun at the beginning of the short story, you got to use it by the end of the short story. So if I show the training at the beginning, I got to make them use it by the end. So the first book starts with a message that Bill Heflin gets from his asset, Boris, who is in a KGB mole for the CIA. The problem is Heflin has never met Boris, Boris is the one who first made contact with him, and he doesn't know why he chose him. Usually, analysts don't have assets. The analysts just analyze intel that comes from the field agents who have their assets. So that's part of the mystery of the first book. Why did Boris pick him, and who was Boris? The other part of the mystery is, why does Boris want him to come to Bucharest? This is December of 89. By this time, the wall has fallen, Berlin Wall, and all the other communist countries have changed from communism to free market democracies. They've done it peacefully. But nobody expects Romania to change peacefully, partly because Ceausescu is a diehard Stalinist, and he's got a tight grip on the country.
He's also a diehard self-interested. His wife was apparently even worse than he, and really loved the money and the power and
absolutely. She's like an Imelda Marcos or one of these people where she barely had a high school education. We're not even sure if she graduated from high school. But she made herself into a PhD professor, the head of the Chemical Academy, and published papers under her name. Of course, she didn't know anything about what she was publishing. She had other scientists do the work. But she loved wealth. Excuse me. And you have to remember what the communist system was like. Everybody stole in the government. They pilfered money from government funds if they were in any position of power. And they hid it in offshore accounts or in other ways. Now, Ceausescu knew this because he was the biggest thief of all. They thought he had over $1 billion in offshore accounts, which they never found, by the way.
And they may still be out there in offshore accounts?
In somebody's offshore accounts, yes, of course. But I give you the answer there as to who found it in the book, in the first book. And so he wanted, basically, if you really think about it, the communist system was a form of oligarch system also. Ceausescu knew that all of his underlings were stealing from the government. He wanted them to get wealthy because they needed to have skin in the game to keep him in power, right? As long as the king remains in power, the oligarchs remain in power. And that is the whole point of the oligarch system. The oligarch is described by Aristotle, actually goes all the way back. Excuse me. And it's not just a rich person. An oligarch is someone who depends, whose wealth depends on the government, on the king, at the mercy of the king. The king can change his mind at any time and take it away. So kings have used oligarchs all the time. They didn't call them that. They call them earls and dukes and barons.
Well, the whole thing is actually like the court of Versailles towards the end.
Absolutely.
I mean, when you think about it, it's very much so. But, the moral lesson there is that at some point, the king loses his head.
That's right. And, it happened in England. It happened everywhere where there was a king. And it happened in Russia when the communists came. But but that is the whole point of the oligarch system. The king creates a network of wealthy people whose wealth depends on him and who are loyal. And they not only give him that power, but they also suppress the rest of the population. So he's got a way of controlling the country. When the communists fell, they used the same system during the transition process. So how did the oligarchs form? Well, the first wave of oligarchs formed when they had to privatize the companies in a communist government. And they all ended up in the hands of a few. And most of these were former or present Securitate people, like the KGB of Russia, like I was telling you. And the reason is that during the communist times, they created millions of files. The Stasi had them, the Bulgarian Secret Service had them, the KGB and the Securitate had millions of files on everyone in the country of any importance. And in these files, they had evidence of corruption. But of course, everybody was corrupt. Now, the reason that Ceausescu made those files is because he would have a way of getting rid of people he didn't like. He would just point to the evidence that he's corrupt and put him in jail or execute him. Never mind the fact that everybody else was doing the same thing.
So it's not that different than China at the moment under Xi, is it? I mean, it's
Russia
the same
right
thing
now.
Going on in Russia.
So these same files after the revolution fell completely into the hands of the Securitate, and they started using them to blackmail everybody in power, including the president himself, judges, parliamentarians, anybody who stood in their way. And through this, through bribes and through blackmail, they gathered all of these assets, mines, banks, chemical plants, factories, and they became wealthy overnight. So the Securitate is the power behind the government ever since then, including to this day. And it has become a kind of a mafia because they've passed it down from generation to generation. It's the children and grandchildren now who are the oligarchs. I'm going to need something.
Sure. So one of the things I thought was really interesting when we traveled from Bucharest up to Transylvania in order to, you know, see the faux Dracula castle, in these beautiful valleys, there would be these long factories, glass, wood, whatever, completely idle. And it turned out that they were built there to sort of give people under communism a job, but they didn't actually make anything. They didn't have a supply system, so they were, it was like a stage set or something. It was astonishing. And the problem now is that trying to get rid of them was be so expensive, you know, to destroy these vacant buildings that are just kind of rusting away. But I mean, it was this system in which, you know, people were paid to work to make nothing. And wow. It was just, I mean, incredible to think that people put up with it.
That was put up with it. That was the system. Everybody had a job. That was what communism promised you.
Ah, so that was it. They faked jobs in order
to... Well, they made jobs.
Right?
What happened afterward, though, the minute that these companies became privatized, they fired half the people because they didn't need them.
Right.
They couldn't be profitable. So immediately after the revolution, 45%, I think I saw the number of the population was unemployed. So what do you do? I mean, some of them started bemoaning the fact that Ceausescu may not have been so bad after all.
You actually run into that in Russia, and we were in Odessa.
Yeah.
Now, there were people who really missed Stalin because, yeah, you know, there was structure in daily life, and people knew the score there. If you've been brought up in that environment, yeah, it's difficult to be in a free market, free society thing and think for yourself, you know, because you're not used to it.
They didn't even work very hard. That's the whole point, because they were so overstaffed. Half the people who didn't have, by the way, grandparents, would go and stand in line because you had to stand in line for food every day for hours on end. I was there during the 80s when there were 200-300 people in a line. Half the time they didn't know what they were in the line for. Hmm. And I asked the guy, and I have a scene like that in the book. I said, you know, what is this line for? And he says, I think it's 42 size galoshes. And I'm like, not everybody here is 42 size, you know, galoshes. He says, by your accent, you were born here, but by your stupidity, you obviously don't live here. He says, we buy whatever they sell, and then we barter it among ourselves.
Yeah.
Okay, that is the system. He says, we've gone back in evolution. We now use the barter system to survive. And it ends up that it might have been eggs that they were selling or you know, pants or whatever. It doesn't matter. They'll find somebody who needs them, who might have eggs or a chicken. Now, everything, like I said, was on a bribe. So if you didn't want to stand in line to buy a slab of beef, you paid the butcher. After about 2 hours, he runs out of meat. He closes the doors. Half the line didn't even get there yet. In the afternoon, he knocks on your door and delivers the beef. And that's how the system worked. If you wanted to buy a car, you had to save up all your money. There were no car loans. And once you did that, you went to the manager. If you didn't give him anything, he would put you at the end of the line, a waiting list. 5 years was the average that you waited for a car to be delivered. If you gave him something, depending on how much you gave him, he'd put you higher on the list. The earliest I ever heard was 1 year, and that's from a government official. So, and there was only one make, the Dacia, which was an old Peugeot model that the French built a factory in Romania at one point. And you could only get it in black and white. And they broke down the first month that you got it. And that was the car system. But everything was on a bribe. Go to a doctor, you have to pay him. If you want a surgery, you better have your grandmother's jewelry there, because otherwise you're not getting surgery. And if you get into a hospital, you got to bring your own sheets and wash them yourself. You got to bring your own food, because they didn't serve you any food. And many times they didn't have the medicines, so you have to go scrounge in the black market to find medicines.
So what would be, why would Bill Heflin be sent to Romania? What asset are there in Romania that would have been worth CIA time?
Oh, well, the problem with Romania was not that it wasn't wealthy. It had great fields for growing grain. Like I said, it was the breadbasket of the whole area. It probably still has oil. It has a lot of natural minerals. The government and the system was the problem. Nobody worked. And so, like I said, Romania between the First and Second World War was a wealthy country. You just have a different system, and suddenly, you know, you have entrepreneurs who, and right now Romania is coming back on its feet, even though there's still a great deal of corruption. So it's not that the land or the country or the people are well-educated. It's the government system that is the problem. So, and the problem, the other thing is, Russia, Gorbachev at the time was in charge, wanted to keep Romania as part of his sphere of influence. The Americans wanted Romania to become part of the European Union and NATO. So there you have two forces that are fighting over Romania.
So that's why there's CIA involvement?
That's why there's CIA involvement, and that's why my theory, which I won't spoil, of how the Romanian Revolution started, it can be explained.
And that's the subject of, the Bucharest dossier. Is that Bill Heflin happens to be in Romania in December of 1989. And I thought your theory was great. I'm sorry we can't discuss it, but yeah. That was really what made the book so compelling. And you'll notice I haven't asked him why it was that Ceausescu got bumped. But, you know, I don't know if there'll ever really be a clear explanation. How is it that, you know, all of a sudden, I mean, you know, people put up with oppression and so forth for decades, and then all of a sudden there seems to be a breaking point.
Right. So it's easier to explain how they put up with oppression for decades. You couldn't make a move there without the Securitate knowing about it.
No, that part I get.
That part you get. Why did it happen that the revolution happened there? Well,
no, don't tell us. It's more better to read it.
I'm not telling you, but that's the question that Romanians today ask themselves 30 years later. They don't know whether it was a revolution or a coup d'etat.
There's a museum in Bucharest that you can go to. In fact, we did go to it. And one of the exhibitions is they had slave labor because, you know, a lot of people that have offended one way or another. And so they had them dig for no reason. They were just digging up these, you know, holes, so to speak. I mean, it's really fascinating to go and watch it. And it was like a chain gang, you know, out of a prison or something. But there wasn't any point to what they were doing other than they were just digging. And, you know, that was the part I think that really threw me as an American to go to a place where, you know, there are factories that, yeah.
Absolutely.
But, you know, but if the myth of communism is that everyone will be employed, you know, and the resources will be divided, then in fact you do have to come up with, even for prisoners, you have to come up with some sort of, you know, task for them to be doing.
Yeah, see, this is the problem. Most people in America who read about communism, like in the 50s with, you know, actors who got the idea that they liked communism. I mean, if you read Marx, doesn't sound so bad. It's all for the common good. You know, you work and you give to the community what you can and you receive what you need.
You know, it's all based on utopia, which never has worked.
Well, it's also kind of a Christian, even though he hated religion, it's kind of a Christian idea, right?
Yeah.
We're all for the common good, blah, blah, blah. But it doesn't work that way because it doesn't take into account human nature. Human nature is aggressive. We are the most aggressive species.
And greedy.
And want to get the better of our neighbor all the time. That's what makes capitalism so successful, because it harnesses to one degree or another until you get excesses, but it harnesses natural instincts of our people for the common good, but doesn't always work perfectly, but it works better than communism. Communism, you have to be a saint, and we're not saints.
True.
We're all fallen people. So that's where communism failed. But you can't get that if you haven't lived there. That's one of the reasons I wrote these two books, to show what a totalitarian government looks like, what it feels like to live there. I mean, all the telephones in Romania came with a microphone inside them from the factory, so they could listen to not only your conversation, but everything that went on in the house. Okay? And so when you went to somebody's home, you usually saw a wire going from the wall into a closet or a drawer. That's where they put the phone, the muffler, the microphone. And so you gotta know what it's like to live under that kind of...
We're doing that voluntarily, though. Think about everybody that has Alexa.
Yeah.
You know, and think about, I mean, they've already shown that, you know, children's toys can eavesdrop, you know, so in a way, you know, we're kind of walking our way into some of the surveillance and other things that, you know, that we're trying. But I guess the difference is that we're doing it voluntarily or out of ignorance that it's actually happening, whereas it was imposed.
We're doing a lot of things out of ignorance. One of the main tools of communism was propaganda. You listen to the same lie every day, you start to believe it. That's just how we're made, unfortunately. And so, especially when you don't have other sources of news, that's happening now in Russia again. It's certainly happening in China, although now with social media, it's less easy to do. But even in America, I don't want to get into
no,
politics.
Let's not go there, right? No, we're not going to do that, but you're right. We are walking ourselves in many ways into some of this situation. Let's talk about the Bucharest legacy. For one thing, the image on the cover, this is the 1010 or 1, whatever it is, room palace that Ceausescu built for himself. And as I said, Bucharest is really a lovely city. It's very French looking and all. And then there's this sort of monstrosity right in the middle of it, you know, which is built along the lines of, as you can tell, sort of almost like brutalist architecture.
Yeah.
They offered, that's the one thing I didn't do. They do give you tours of it, but they say it's just basically all, you know, empty rooms with nothing in them. So I took a pass and went to see the crown jewels instead, which I thought was way more fun.
You should see it because it's just, he spent, I don't know how many billions, 20-something billion, gold leaf.
Exactly.
All sorts of rare carpets and stuff while the people were starving, standing in line, you know. It was just amazing. It's larger than the Pentagon, apparently. It's got an underground bunker to withstand nuclear weapon for him.
Right.
So that's Ceausescu. Now... 3 years later, with the Bucharest legacy, I try to show, well, it starts with Heflin going back to Bucharest because he just exfiltrated a defector, a KGB defector. And defector comes to Langley and says, you have a mole inside your agency. And not only do you have a mole, but we think we know who the handler is. You guys know him by the name of Boris. Well, Boris was Heflin's asset in the KGB. So if it's the same Boris we're talking about, it means that all this time he wasn't Heflin's asset, he was giving us wrong information, and that he was actually handling a mole inside the CIA. And the obvious answer as to who that mole is Heflin. So he has to go back to Romania and clear his name. Of course, he has one secret, which we won't tell you, that nobody else knows, and which we divulge at the end of the first book.
Right. So it's interesting. You had to come up with a reason for him to go back.
I wanted to show Romania in 1993, 3 years after the revolution, long-awaited democracy and capitalism that everybody was dreaming about never materialized because of many reasons. But one is that the oligarchs stole the country's assets, basically. Now, it is better off today than it was under communism, no doubt. But whichever country, whichever party is in control, whichever president, the oligarchs really are the ones that control the country because they control most of the assets.
But when I looked it up today, I could see that the creeping effect of communism, I mean of capitalism, is because the beautiful Athene Palace, which was an independent hotel when I was there, and I think it was like 2617 or something, is now, I'm trying to remember, part of one of the
Hilton.
Now, is it a Hilton? I thought it was something slightly more glamorous than Hilton. But anyway, it's part of one of the, you know, major hotel chains now. So just in a fairly short time, it has gone from being, you know, an independently operated hotel to part of a capitalist, you know, conglomerate, so to speak.
It wasn't that short, actually. When I went back after, you know, the revolution, I thought somebody would gobble it up because it is so beautiful in its structure when it was originally built, and the communists, you know, messed it up during the communist days. But I thought somebody would pick it up and refurbish it. It took them, I don't know, I think more than 10 years or longer before some Western, I think it was, whatever it was.
It's an intercontinental. That's what it just comes to me now. It's an intercontinental.
No, right? The Intercontinental is a different hotel. The Intercontinental is next to the university and the National Theater.
Ah.
So maybe that is this a modern hotel that you stayed at? That is
No. It's
well, that's the
old
Intercontinental.
No. The Athenae Palace is very, very Parisian. Very.
Yes. So I think it's a Hilton, but it's though the Intercontinental is.
Anyway, it's not independent, which is sort of my point. Was that it's already moved down. Well, we were in Rangoon in whenever it was, 2012. There was. The British had left, and the Burmese, now the Myanmar, whatever they call themselves, anyway, of all the countries that the British had as part of their colonial empire, they're the ones, along with one in Africa, Mozambique, I think it is, it was throughout everything. They didn't keep the post office, they didn't keep the railroads, they didn't keep a single thing. And as a consequence, you know, they descended into just terrible poverty because they didn't know how to run anything. It was really interesting. So we were there with the first sort of wave, first trip down the river. And I was I stood there and I thought to myself, you know, that the problem with a country like that is throwing off what they view as oppression and so forth, is they don't really know how to run anything.
That's very interesting that you say that, because my next book is going to be about that in Russia. And what happened in Russia, and if you read several books that have been written about Putin, like Putin's Men, and there was another book about Putin, what happened right after the revolution, well, before the revolution, what happened during Andropov's days, during the late 70s and 80s, was that the communist leaders realized they were losing. They were 20, 30 years behind the West. They couldn't keep up. They couldn't even provide the basics. So what they did was they started joining forces with the black market. Now, there was already a black market during the communist days that were involved in, they were stealing basically minerals and grain and oil, and they were getting food in and other things that the government couldn't provide. So they started making a deal with the black market. So the first free enterprise people in Russia that knew anything about free enterprise were these black marketeers, okay? But nobody else knew how to run a free market system. So when the communism fell and Yeltsin decided that this is going to be now a free market system, they couldn't find people who knew how to run a free market system. The Russian people didn't know what it means to save for old age, what it means to get interest on your investment, all of these things that we take for granted, what it means to get a loan, which you then repay with interest and so forth. So they had to go to the heads of the black markets now, which had become quite powerful in those days because they were providing more and more of the stuff that the government couldn't provide. And these black marketeers became the next generation of entrepreneurs together with the KGB and in Romania, the Securitate, because they knew, because they had lived in Europe, they had the contacts in Europe, and they knew how to run a free enterprise capitalist system.
So there's a lot to learn. You can read these books. Now, what I didn't mention is that in order to tell the story in the Bucharest Legacy, part of the time we're in 1993, but part of the time we're in 1973, is it?
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
Right. So there is a two-part story because we have to go back into the past in order to get to the present. And you are not writing this as a first person. You're writing this because it's too complicated a story to do that.
It's too complicated to write it only from one point
right.
of view.
Right. You couldn't really do that given the time jumps and all the different characters in it.
And you have to bring different points of view. Like, because if you only show it from the hero's point of view, how are you going to show what's going on with the enemy, what they're doing? You know, it's very difficult to do.
Right.
Most spy novels are written in the third person, although there are some in the first. Now, you know, not all spy novels are the same. You got very action-packed spy novels on one end, and you got Jean Le Carré on the other. And
right.
I don't know if you call that a spy thriller. I like more of a thinking person's spy novel.
So, I think a big characteristic of it is that you never can work out who to trust. You know, you as a reader can't, that's part of the journey is trying to figure out who you could trust, who the mole, yeah. You know, if there is a mole might be. And you draw very heavily on, what's his name, James Jesus Angleton, who
yes.
practically, you know, ruined the CIA for his 20-year tenure because he was so convinced. I think he was spooked by the Cambridge Five, but he was so convinced there was a mole within the CIA that his efforts to find the mole really more or less destroyed any kind of morale in the agency.
Right, because nobody could trust anybody anymore, you see?
Yeah.
You could be the mole, maybe, you know, and it goes back again. It harkens back to what we talked about, the Securitate. Anywhere from 1 out of 4 to 1 out of 10 people in Romania was either working for the Securitate or an informant. But you didn't know who it was. It could be your cousin, could be your workmate, it could be your lover. And so everybody was afraid of talking to anybody else. They couldn't trust anybody. That was the whole point. Because you ask, why didn't they revolt in 40 years? You got two people talking to each other. You don't know if your friend is
right. No, you know, my question was, why didn't they revolt in 40 years? My question was, what was the
point
final,
yeah.
you know, thing that
right.
finally got them to do it? But I mean, if you read Le Carré, we had a discussion last night with Matthew Quirk, who was here, wrote The Night Agent.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that, I guess it wasn't Matthew, it was Matt Goldman, that's the big Le Carré fan. But, you know, we were in the book I just gave you to read, The Sparrow,
yes.
The Peacock and the Sparrow. I keep wanting to call it The Peacock and the Scorpion. I'm convinced because the scorpion sounds more like, you know, the whole trust issue thing that the sparrow does. And that takes place in Bahrain. And it has, you know, they're not really action driven. They're more, you know, inquiries into character and belief systems and, you know, and they're a variation on trust no one. I mean, they really are. It's almost the same thing as the whole trust no one psychological suspense thing, because, you know, who is a reliable narrator? You know, who,
right,
whose goals are on the table and whose are secret and who will turn anybody in for gain.
And it's more realistic. If you talk to real CIA agents, they say, we never wear a gun. I mean, we are there to develop assets, to find, you know, secrets, right? And how do we find them? By engaging with people in the government who know them.
But that's another really interesting question is what, when that came up, I think, Matt, what would motivate somebody to, in fact, you know, offer up themselves as an asset? Would it just be for money? Would it be ideology? Would it be, you know, why? If somebody came in here, Patrick, and said, you know, I want to secretly out back in the parking lot recruit you for the CIA, you know, what would they offer you that would lead you, you know, to take that up? I mean, a lot of what we've seen recently has just been money, like that couple that they arrested. Remember, the guy worked for the Navy and they just wanted to sell whatever it was he had for big bucks. But then you've got the Texera guy or whatever it is, and he's in there for bragging rights. It really wasn't about money. It was about showing off and power. So there are, you know, complex reasons why people are willing to be assets.
They're complex reasons. And during the communist days, I mean, there was ideology when you recruited somebody from the other side, but there are also ideology coming this way. The Cambridge Five believed in communism until they actually had to go live in Moscow when they were caught, and they hated it. They all became drunks, and basically,
yeah. But you know, I think some of that was that superiority thing. You know, they loved having a secret that other people didn't have. I thought we had a good discussion about that. Actually, what would motivate somebody like Kim Philby to, you know, because he could be like secretly one up on everybody else. So you know, I think the complexities of all of this are amazing.
And then, of course, you can, you know, you can spring honey traps on agents, and you can blackmail them and so forth. So a lot of them are becoming assets.
Or you can endanger one of their family, or you could have, you know, look at the whole thing with Hunter Biden, for example. You know, in a different society, poor old Joe might really be hanging out to dry here because his, you know, his kid obviously does not have great judgment. So, you know, I mean, basically spy stories are really about the complexities of human nature.
And, oh, absolutely. And that's what intrigues me. It's not so much the shooting. It's the motivation, the character. And, you know, one of the reasons Boris continues to live in the second book is his ideology is one of eventually sharing secrets with everybody. Because his idea is the more we share, the less we have to hide, the more really we realize that we're wasting billions on our military and everything else. So he was a kind of an idealist, you know, peace link.
Well, there's a lot of fun stuff in the book, like the martial arts parts. And I marked a whole bunch of things, which, of course, I haven't now turned to, comments about the CIA. I've got a whole bunch of pages here, Dogger. And I like, there's, you know, we've mentioned that spying is going back to old school and, you know, back to the drop and all. So, of course, in 1993, it is old school. So, you know, there's the tree in the park. And there's the, you know, the written note from Boris. Dear Vasily, I'm back from my little vacation. I'm ready to restart our previous arrangement. I'm glad our usual dead drop is still functioning. Send packages when ready. But is this really Boris, you know, or did somehow or other the secret of the tree with the arrow, you know, get? I mean, that's the other thing is that, you know, how do you actually identify right. anybody.
Well, he's got it backwards, though. He says, send packages when ready.
Right.
It's the other way around. Boris is the one who's right. sending packages to him.
Well, yeah. Anyway, is this basically a duology? I mean, you've told the story. Are you?
I've told the story about Romania. The next one will be.
Are you keeping Bill or?
I'm keeping Bill.
Okay, but he's going to go somewhere else.
Yeah, he's going to go somewhere else. I have a movie option deal for the Bucharest dossier, and they want me to write at least 3 novels with Bill Heflin.
Great.
So we'll see if it ever gets made.
Well, you know, they're doing a lot of filming in Romania. I'm trying to remember which, what was it? The Amazon version of The Lord of the Rings? They filmed a lot of it in not in New Zealand, but they filmed a lot of it.
Well, Romania is a great place. They have a very good film industry and a theater. One of the things the communists didn't ruin in Romania is the theater. They used to put a lot of great Shakespeare and so forth. Mm. But because of its streets, it's got cobblestone streets and so forth, it can be used to represent.
Right. It didn't get modernized due to all that. And also, there's some really beautiful scenery, mountains, the Carpathians, you know, all of that. Maybe the movie industry will finally take down these horrible factories because, no, I'm serious, you know, because it's so incredibly expensive to, you know, to demolish them. That maybe the film industry will decide, could make a great, they could just blow it up in one of the movies. It'd be fabulous. Haul it off. I love that. Anyway, it's really been a pleasure to talk to you. And I think for any of you who are interested in, you know, a part of the world about which you know very little, these are two really interesting gateway novels into it. But I do think they're a pair. I really do. So I urge you to try the Bucharest Dossier and then read the Bucharest Legacy. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Is there a question from the audience? No question. All right. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.